Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, and it's always a pleasure to be talking to her, is poet and photographer Alexis Roan Fancher. We're talking about her new chapbook, Junkie Wife. Alexis, welcome back to the show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I want to talk about Junkie Wife. When you put out a book like this, which is a chapbook, and it's out on Moontide Press, and I want to promote that because they put out a lot of poetry books that are really interesting. You didn't write all these one right after another sequentially in the idea of telling a story, correct?
Not sequentially, and not correct. I really set out to tell the story of my first marriage in a chapbook in a small collection. They didn't come sequentially, and eventually they were ordered and reordered, written over maybe a two-year period.
Wow. That was some first marriage. Now, at the beginning of this book, you say no names were changed, no one was innocent. And so everybody's name in this is their actual name?
Maybe.
Don't get coy with me, Alexis.
There are no last names. And
no, but there are obvious. I mean, these refer to real people and real incidences. Yes. I feel like I was watching a movie the entire time I was reading these poems.
Oh, good. That's what I intended. I wanted to make it a visual journey, you know?
As a matter of fact, to the point, has anybody ever suggested making a film of this book yet?
No, but I like that idea very much.
I mean, I could see the poems being read in between scenes from the film. It's very sensual. It's very real. It's also pretty powerful. What a disastrous first marriage. That's going to go down in history as some of the worst first marriage I've ever heard of.
Well, and if you think that it all took place over 1 year, beginning to me leaving him, it was quite a year. You know, for a long time, Mark, I looked at that first marriage from the viewpoint of a victim.
Right.
You know, someone who was a victim in this whole scheme of my ex-husband and my ex-best friend and I falling down that rabbit hole. But when I wrote this book, the one thing I determined before I started was that I was going to own up to my part in the madness.
Okay.
And my part in all of it. And once I looked at it from those eyes, it changed everything for me. I became powerful in my own story because I accepted my responsibility.
I totally get that. I was going to ask you if this was incredibly cathartic to get this out on paper.
I think the catharsis came as much from making my mind up to be responsible, to not be a victim, but to be a perpetrator like the other two. That's when everything shifted for me. It was one of the few areas where I had not owned up to my own responsibilities.
Right.
In my life, you know. The thing about writing confessional poetry, for lack of a better word, is that, you know, you get a chance to go back and look at it and really distill it, you know, and then say, wow, look at this. Probably my favorite thing about writing poetry.
A lot of your poetry is, I guess you would call it confessional poetry, but it's not preachy at all. And there's a sense of reality about it that, like I said, is both grim and refreshing.
Thank you.
But this is you know, every book you release, it's sort of a new level of intensity. This seemed to be, because we're talking about, okay, yes, there was three people involved in a relationship, but the X factor in here is addiction and junk. which just sort of screws up everything. And talk to me about that in relationship to the relationship.
When I met Ronnie, I was doing narcotics. I had been in a horrific accident, car accident, at the age of 20. I was not driving, but I was the only one who didn't die. And after a year in the hospital, I was left with a, not so much as an addiction for opiates, but a longing for them, because then I didn't have to think, I didn't have to look at what had happened to me, and I didn't have to do anything. And when things got tough, I would go back there, and I had access to opiates, and I exploited that. And when I met Ronnie, I was an on-again, off-again junkie, never physically addicted, but emotionally so. And he wanted to fix me. He was a fixer. He liked broken women. And he knew everything about me when he asked me to marry him. You know, go figure.
Now, talk to me about junk versus love and sex, because one of the things that comes out in this book is several points that junk is better than sex a lot of times.
I think so. I mean, I don't think so now.
Right.
I've been clean for decades, but you know, junk didn't make demands on you, other than that you keep using it. But junk was a lullaby, and love, I didn't have a handle on love. I didn't know how to get it, how to keep it. I was lost.
And this is the poems really capture that lost feeling, and then the sort of real anger and desperation when you feel that you've been cheated on too. I mean, there's a great poem about pulling up to Ronnie and I forgot it, Vicky. Oh God, that, what a perfect name! In your car, and that just to me really captured the power of that feeling of being wronged. Can you read that poem?
Sure.
I forget.
It's called Chance Encounter, and it comes almost at the end of the book after the split has occurred. Chance Encounter. Tooling down Sunset, I saw them, her riding shotgun in the blue beater Chevy, him at the wheel. They were one lane over, two cars up. I pulled parallel, rolled down my window, stuck out my arm, and waved. Vicky slumped in shame the way she had when I'd broken her nose, her face turning white as the bandages she was still wearing. I watched her slink in the seat until she disappeared, revealing my husband, red-faced, apoplectic. Why can't you just leave us alone? He yelled. Like I was stalking them, like I even cared.
You know, that reads exactly like a movie script. It really does.
Oh, yay.
It's got all the direction and all the action. It's a perfect scene for a film.
Wow, you're giving me all sorts of good ideas, Mark. Thank you.
I would love to see this as a film. Now, knowing all this, and we're going to hear more of your poetry later, a weird thing occurred to me. Being a poet as long as you have, do you have to have lived a somewhat interesting life in order to be a successful artist and poet? Because I just, you know, I read your poetry. I'm taken away by it. I'm fascinated. But you've lived a lot of life and had a lot of bad things happen. And I kept thinking, like, is some Midwestern cheerleader who's got a middle management job going to ever be a successful poet? And I need to hear your opinion on that.
Well,
you know what I'm saying? You need some background. You need some stuff in there in order to get it out on the page. Don't you?
For me, yes. I was always a writer. I wrote in high school. I wrote in college. But I really pretty early on discovered that I didn't have an authentic voice. Nothing had really happened to me, you know. I had lived this sort of upper middle class, normal two-parent family upbringing, done all the things I was supposed to do, and I had nothing to say. I've only been sending my work out for publication since the end of 2012, and only really writing for about 10 years now. So by then I had, you know, I'd had a lot of things happen. I had a lot of things to draw on. And as I said earlier, I really wanted at this point in my life to take out all of these memories, almost like jewels in a box. You know, kind of really delve deeply into them and see what I could see about my own life.
But that's my point. You need those jewels in the box to go to. You know, I've heard an awful lot of bad poetry from young people. But I just noticed, for instance, the poets you've introduced me to, other poets that I've had on the show, are people have a wealth of experience by which they're drawing, as you talked about, getting those jewels in the box. And I just think you need something, you need experience in order to put something down on paper that's worthwhile reading.
You know, I don't think that you can 100% know that's true.
That's what I need to hear from you. I need to hear that, yeah.
I know several very young poets. A poet I'm very impressed with named Lila Chatty, for example, who's in her late 20s, early 30s maybe, and has been writing extraordinary old soul poems. I think it happens differently for different people. Me, I needed to live in order to write. Look at Sylvia Plath. She died in her early 30s, and she was writing brilliantly in her teens. So I wish I could.
But she had other stuff. She had stuff going on in her life too that she drew on. You know, the deep seated anger, and all sorts of other things that had gone on in her life. And I guess it's not the age that I'm thinking about. It's the experience that you have to have a perspective and an experience that sort of comes, well, I guess with intelligence, and maybe not necessarily with age or lessons learned. Maybe, I don't know.
I think it's about having the ability to step back and take a look and kind of move away from you being in it and being able to look at your life more, as you say, like a film, where you can be an observer and yet you can also be a participant. I mean, I often write in the first person, but I will just as easily write, you know, about someone else who's really me so that I can write in the third person, you know.
Nice.
It depends. It depends on how you can best say what you want to say, right?
Yeah. I mean, you're the poet. I'm definitely not the poet. I know that. I do visual art, but I'm definitely not the poet. And when I come across really good poetry like yours, I'm just amazed. And talk to me about the honing process of getting a poem for you. I'm not talking about in general. I'm talking about for you. Getting a poem down on paper. How many rewrites do you do? How do you work at it?
I always take notes. I have a notes function on my iPhone, and I'm constantly, as soon as I think of something, I'm writing it down before it disappears. And I'll often go to those notes and start fleshing them out. Sometimes I'll do work on a poem. I'm working on a poem right now about Kate Spade, who sadly passed away this week. And I'll have 20, 30 pages sometimes of notes that I'll draw from. I usually write 8-10 different drafts. I have a couple of friends who are wonderful poets, and we read each other's work. My friend, the poet Chanel Brenner, and I have for many, many years shared work. I mean, she always sees everything I write first and vice versa. I have a paid editor. I have friend editors. I have people that I implore to just read this and tell me what you think. I rarely have a poem come out full formed. It's a process, and sometimes it's a week, sometimes it can be years.
I was going to say, do you put poems away and then look at it months later?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Sometimes I'll have even sent poems out and then looked at them and said, maybe I can make it better. edited things like that, or edited poems that have been published for a book, you know, like a collection, and I'll have reworked them. So I don't know if they're ever finished.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch, my returning guest tonight, and it's always a pleasure to talk to her. It's poet and photographer Alexis Rhone Fancher, and we're talking about her new chapbook. It's a really great collection called Junkie Wife. I also want to say that it's a very tough collection and a very honest collection. I want to talk about your photography for a moment, because we email each other back and forth about this. I am knocked out by your photography, and you seem to be very blasé about it. I mean, your photography seems to be as big an accomplishment to me because of the quality of it and the sort of long-term project you have of photographing poets that come through LA or that you come in contact with. Have you exhibited yet?
I've had a few exhibits over the years. I had a huge one in 2015 at Beyond Baroque, which is the number one cultural institution here in Los Angeles. You know, I think for me, Mark, poetry is hard. Poetry is work. Poetry is sweat, and it makes me think. And photography, I've been photographing regularly since I was 10, and it's second nature. I always have a camera in my hand, around my neck. I use my iPhone 12. I use, you know, whatever I can to make it happen, but it's not hard. It doesn't take any thought or effort, really. Even when I photograph people here at my studio, it's just second nature. So I don't think it, to me, it's just something I do for fun.
But does that give you less pleasure because it's for fun, or more pleasure than poetry, or just a different kind of pleasure?
Well, you know, every once in a while I send out photographs for publication, and they always, I'd say about 80% of the time they get picked up, which is a far higher percentage than my poetry.
there's a deeper meaning there.
I don't know.
I think people judge poetry harsher than they judge photography, maybe. But I'll tell you, you have two basic bodies of work in photography. You have one of these portraits of poets and artists, mostly poets, that either come to your studio or you actually photograph while they're reading. And then you have street scenes, which are just a completely whole different body of work. And I am always just amazed that you sort of just go around photographing as if like it's like you're breathing. You know, it's like you just sort of do it. And I think your photographs are really dynamite.
Thank you. You know, people keep saying, why don't you put a book out?
I'm one of those people.
Well, but my response, I think, should be, although I'm too reticent to ever say that, is why don't you fund one? Why don't you bankroll me? You know, you're looking at $5,000-$6,000 to put out anything of quality, and the, you know, to do books and whatever, and an enormous amount of work and curating.
I know.
And
it would cease to be fun.
I think so. I think if I had someone who wanted to do that and was willing to work with me, you know, like if I were a Mary Ellen Mark or Annie Leibovitz or something, where I'd have people, you know, wanting to work with me and doing that. I have hundreds of thousands of extraordinary photos and probably several thousand, you know, just film proofs and negatives. So It would be a job. It would be a huge job. Why, do you know someone who wants to do it?
I don't know, but let's use this show to promote it. I can tell you, my idea for your book would be to have your portraits and their poetry opposite each other for an entire book on that sort of area's poetry and poets. I think that would be a fantastic go-to project.
I would love to
read that, and the rest of the poets would too. So anybody out there that's listening, contact Alexis, because it really needs to be done. She has the work is done essentially, and all you have to do is just assemble it. That's all. She just needs the bucks. So come on.
Thank you.
Seriously, Alexis, I want you to read another poem because I love hearing you read.
Thank you. Let's see. Why I prefer injectable narcotics. The truth that impales me each time I get straight. It's all cake once I found a good vein. I surrender to the dazzling foreplay, loosen the belt, ease back the plunger, watch my blood flood the syringe. The gasp, the breath catch just before I jam the plunger down, just like you plunge into me, my cheeks flush. And the rush, the ride, the afterglow, better than sex. Correction, better than sex with you, I mean.
Wow. That's powerful from so many points of view.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you about eroticism in your poetry and sexuality. You deal with sex, and we can't read those poems, some of them, over the air here just because of restrictions. But I want to say you treat sexuality in a very normal way. But at the same point, there are poems that you write that are sexually arousing. Talk to me about writing work like that, and you're putting an awful lot of yourself out there for the public to read about. Have you ever had any trepidations about that?
Wow, that's several questions.
I know that.
No trepidations, fear.
There's an art to writing the sexual and the erotic. And you sort of got a knack for that. How did you? I mean, that's got to be one of the more difficult things to write about. Although when I think about your life, there's a lot more difficult things to write about. Talk to me about the art of writing about that, because it's difficult to put it across so it's real and not sensationalized.
I like to think that I am writing the space around the sex.
Yes.
You know, I think when people, when writers slip into the pornographic is when they're talking about, when they're writing about body parts as opposed to the feeling around it. And at the same time, not using the right name for a body part. I had a young student, I take on clients and students, and she was talking about, she'd been reading a lot of 20th century and 19th century erotic poetry, and it was his member and you know, her purse. And I mean, it was just like, oh my God. I think writing erotica is very, very hard. Writing sex is very hard. And I've had great poets try and say to me, damn, I had no idea. I don't know. I love sex. I'm wired that way. I always have great sex. I had many years ago, an astrologer look at my chart, and the first thing he said to me, he said, you always have great sex. And I said, how do you know? He said, it's in your chart. All your planets are in Venus. Your Venus is in Scorpio, blah, blah.
Uh-oh.
Anyway, for me, it's, some people can write about cooking. Some people can write about sports. And for me, I see things sexually, I think, is maybe the answer. Huh. I see things in those images, and that's how I navigate my life. I don't think I've ever looked at a man or a woman without thinking, you know, I wonder how it would be to have sex with them.
Okay. It comes off. It comes off as very real. And I guess that's the best compliment that I can say.
Thank
it
you.
Feels real. It sounds real. Can I ask you to read one more poem? Because we're going to almost out of time. And I would love to figure it out.
Let's see. I'm going to read one of my favorites from the book. No, it's okay. excuse me. Divorce Court.
Yes,
Barbie.
That's one of my favorites too.
Divorce Court Barbie. Ken drives away with all my things. I was no fairy tale bride, but I came with a Barbie daybed, a bath fun playset, and a large pink Desire Barbie dildo vibrator for when Ken forgot to come home. But he couldn't keep it in his Ken fashionista trousers. He parked his glam convertible with silver rims in Skipper's driveway, stashed his GPS in her long and short of it pants. Then he drove out of her dinner date playset and back to our Barbie dream house, packed a few things in my store-it-all carrying case, and dropped me at the Barbie Grand Hotel like I was so much Euro trash. Look, Your Honor, nobody came with a warranty, but unlike Ken, my intentions were pure. I lived up to my good housekeeping seal. But Ken and Barbie have sex before marriage playset, made sure Ken knew what he was getting into. Then he got into Skipper. I know what you must think, Your Honor. There are names for dolls like me. Bad luck, Barbie. Throw away, Barbie. The one Ken swears he wouldn't love if I were the last girl on earth, Barbie. The one who's rendered worthless once you trash the box.
And with that, we're going to end. And that's just a sample of the poems in this book. My returning guest tonight has been poet and photographer Alexis Roan Fancher. We've been talking about her new chapbook. It's really worth getting. Junkie Wife. Alexis, it's a pleasure as always.
Thank you. Likewise. Thank you, Mark.
You listen to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.